Welcome, everybody, to Productivity Book Group. I'm your host and facilitator, Ray Sidney Smith. Thanks for joining us here on the live call or on the podcast for Productivity Book Group. Today on this call, we will be discussing Nudge, Improving Decisions About Health, Wealth, and Happiness by University of Chicago economist Richard Thaler and Harvard Law School professor Cass Sunstein. So I'm just going to read the Amazon book description just so you have an idea about the book, and then we'll kick into the conversation. And so the description starts as, quote, "Nudge is about choices, how we make them and how we can make better ones. Drawing on decades of research in the fields of behavioral science and economics, authors Richard H. Thaler and Cass R. Sunstein offer a new perspective on preventing the countless mistakes we make, ill-advised personal investments, consumption of unhealthy foods, neglect of our natural resources, and show us how sensible choice architecture, as they call it, can successfully nudge people toward the best decisions. In the tradition of the tipping point and Freakonomics, Nudge is a straightforward, informative, and entertaining, a must-read for anyone interested in our individual and collective well-being," end quote. So with that said, what are your thoughts regarding the book's description? Do you agree or disagree with it as a whole? Just let's kick off the conversation and hear what your general feelings are about the book so far.
Well, I think the description that you read is right on point. Having had a couple of courses, I'm a retired school administrator, and in those administrative preparation courses, I actually had a couple that were actually on decision making, and a lot of what we read in here, some of the examples, remind me of things from that course as far as just the way we as human beings tend to perform.
How about you, Lee?
I don't know that I have a whole lot to add to that. There's a lot there, as we discussed before the call, there's a lot there about decision making at a bigger and policy level, as well as at an individual level, which makes it an interesting read in switching back and forth between how do you do things kind of day-to-day, minute-to-minute, and why does that happen, and how are you affected by choices that people and organizations you encounter have made? And I think that's kind of in the deeper parts of the review as well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And so, you know, as you said, I think that this book is one of, you know, great importance, I think, in public dialogue and public discourse. And at the same time, I felt like, you know, it's one of those books that has caused quite a bit of controversy and stir in not only the economics field, but also among public policy makers and that kind of thing. And so I think this is going to be a really wonderful discussion around all of those things. I first wanted to start off with defining this new concept that they have sort of put out there. Maybe it's not a new concept, but they've given a term to a concept, what they call libertarian paternalism. And in essence, they've turned libertarian paternalism into the verb nudge, or into the concept of nudge and nudge theory. So let's start off with how do you define this idea of libertarian paternalism, and what does it really mean in the context of what we're going to be talking about today? Anybody want to take a stab at that?
Well, you know, to me, it's sort of reminds me of the, you know, that parent who, instead of telling the child what to do, sets up the situation so that the child makes that particular choice. So it's sort of like, well, you know, rather than government, for example, legislating this or that. I think one example was being required to have a motorcycle helmet, which we know is a good thing, but at the same time, other people might say, nah, I don't need that. I'm a great rider. So how can we set up a system that won't say, you must do this, but at the same time encourage people to do the thing that, for example, government wants them to do?
Thank you. Yeah, I think that it's really interesting. I, you know, libertarian is used in the sense that it avoids coerciveness In this particular case, they're talking about this on a more, global level, in the sense of, or macro level, government or some kind of body over you, not coercing you into making decisions, and paternalism in the fact that it tries to influence our choices, so that we make better ones, assumingly as decided by ourselves. And I think that that's really an interesting concept. So libertarian paternalism is this combination of two potentially incendiary words. People tend to think about them very differently, but put together, I think it's something that the authors believe can have bipartisan support, at least in a U.S.-based political sort of arena, and, around that. The book defines a nudge as, quote, a nudge, as well as, it says, as they'll use the term, is any aspect of the choice architecture that alters people's behavior in a predictable way without forbidding any options or significantly changing their economic incentives. To count as a mere nudge, the intervention must be easy and cheap to avoid. Nudges are not mandates. Putting fruit at eye level counts as a nudge. Banning junk food does not, end quote. So it's this idea of being able to, positive reinforce, these suggestive, non-coercive things for people to be able to comply with. And this is all the underpinnings of what's now considered nudge theory. Let's talk a little bit about this concept of nudge. What do you feel about the idea as a whole? Do you believe it has merit? And, where might you find the concept of choice architecture in your own lives? So, and who might be the choice architects in your life, or, that you might be the choice architect in your life as well? But, what is choice architecture to you? How is it applicable to you, and potentially can you help?
Go
ahead
and be
first.
Okay.
Oh, hi, Rhonda. How's it going, Rhonda?
Hi. Okay. I actually changed my bookmark system on my web browser because I was acting in a way that wasn't really serving my interests. I would have, my social media and all these time wasters. The first thing I saw when I opened up my browser. So I put those things into a folder called entertainment. So now I know that if I'm looking there, it's for entertainment. It's not like I've done my work, I've checked everything. So I changed the architecture, the design of my web browser, the way the bookmarks were arranged. So I was my own choice architect. So what I really want to see first that's really going to serve, let's say, my interests and the interests of society or the interests of the greater good, things that are what the nudge is about. Without coercion, it's, guiding people to take actions that are for the greater good. So, I think I did do something, it is hard to be nudged. Everyone's different, all the human beings are different, and different nudges might affect different human beings. Not like there's some nudge, but I think the web browser, everyone is using that, so it's a good tool. If you can organize your web browser so that it nudges you in the right direction, I think it's useful.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sort of like you remove the chocolate candy from the web browser and put the chocolate away somewhere else. Yeah.
Or not buying the junk food in the first place, so that when you're at home and stressed out or hungry, you're not inclined to be able to use that. That's fantastic. Actually, Rhonda, there's a book called, I think, is it 21 Tips for Productivity by Augusto Pinaud? He's a productivity coach, and Augusto talks about the idea of having two separate independent browsers, one for work and one for personal. And so you're doing something very similar. You're creating an easy piece of friction to allow yourself the choice of doing what you believe is the right thing at the right time. So that's really great, and welcome to Productivity Book Group. Lee, you had something to say.
So choice architecture was actually my favorite term in the entire book. And I think this is an incredibly pervasive aspect of our lives today. Not only at the level of tricks like Rhonda mentioned and similar kinds of productivity hacks for kind of channeling your own behavior into desired paths as opposed to possibly shiny objects, if you will, of whatever sort. But in terms of user interface design in the broadest sense, so I mean that even in the sense of Disney at Disneyland and Disney World long ago started doing things to change crowd behavior and how people end up queuing and things like that. On the Nudge blog, I was just looking at that this morning. There's a lovely example of a commercial, and not necessarily totally for the greater good kind of nudge, where a software company gives you the choice of the free version or the paid version, and there's a little table with the features of each, and at the bottom there's a bright blue button for the paid version, and there's a gray button for the free version. And the gray button works, but that's not what you're drawn to. On the positive side, one of the changes that's being pushed for companies to do is to change 401k sign-up to be the default, so that you have to uncheck the box, if you will, not to save for retirement. So I think it's something that in any kind of interactions we have with our own environments as we control them, but also a huge portion of the external environment that we live in, nudges are being used, and a choice architecture has been developed. And that can be a good or a bad thing. I think it's really a tool. Certainly the whole idea of the libertarian paternalism is intended to point at the good side of that. But like most things, it's a tool that can be used for almost anything in terms of pushing people towards a particular behavior or choice.
Yeah, I definitely agree, Lee. And one of the things that, you know, I'd like to sort of discuss as we talk about this is this idea of, you know, the background in history that, you know, social science, economics, and basically public policy research has sort of led us down this path of, you know, I mean, from, you know, Dr. Daniel Kahneman and the late Dr. Amos Tversky, you know, their work. And, you know, they wrote a book called Judgment Under Certainty, and as well as Kahneman's, you know, bestseller, Thinking Fast and Slow. You know, there's Dan Ariely's Predictably Irrational. All of this material talks about some of the interesting premises about how humans think, sometimes in error and irrationally. And therefore, choice architecture in a way is needed. I mean, design thinking is needed and systems thinking is needed so that we're able to make better choices in sort of the, you know, overcrowded world of choice and decisions. And, so the book sort of starts off with this premise of having what Daniel Kahneman has researched and talked about, which is sort of the thinking and remembering self, right? Or they call it the automatic and the reflective systems. And, you know, these conflicts between those systems or differences between the systems have created these fallacies and biases that we you know, start to do. They talk about the herd mentality and the anchoring and so on and so forth that we do as humans. And I'm curious about anybody's thoughts about, you know, what your feelings were about your own ability to make choices and, you know, obviously your productive life. You know, do you feel like this informed you better? And will you make better choices? It sounds like for Rhonda, it did, you know, because you made an immediate decision and sort of change in your life, Rhonda. Whereas, you know, what are some other folks' thoughts in terms of how you sort of dealt with that new information, if it was new information?
Yeah, and again, for me, a lot of it was a review of what I had had in doctoral level courses. I think it may help us to see some of the tricks that others are forcing on us. As Lee was talking, it reminded me of a situation just the other day when I was in a hotel room, checked into the hotel, and went to get on the internet, and you had the free version and the paid version. So you click, I want the complimentary free version. And then as you're going through the steps then and clicking the buttons to log on, then here comes another bit, like Lee said, a big button, do you want to upgrade? And a little bitty link that, no, I'm fine with the free version. After you've already said, I want the free one, then as part of just the log on process, was something pretty well designed to get you to follow the herd, accept the default, and upgrade. So I think those sort of tricks are out there. And I think everyone who is in the job of selling is probably using that because they can't legislate that you buy their product, but they've got to use these nudges, so to speak, to get you to do the things that they want you to do.
Absolutely agree. There's, you know, the idea of using nudges in almost every aspect of life, from, you know, managing teams to organizations, to your family life, and as you talked about, you know, parenting, and teachers with students, they do a lot of this kind of stuff, you know, that really, you know, makes that happen. And then, of course, among any group, you know, environment, whether that be your church group or, you know, volunteer group that you might be a part of, you know, if you're having to make choices and decisions for people, you really have to you have to start thinking about the responsibility you have to how you, what choices you put in front of people and the order in which you make those choices available to them. I'm curious then, you know, what are some situations where nudges can make a difference? You know, we've heard a couple of examples so far, but, you know, I'd like to hear from you all, you know, what types of situations nudges can make a difference, and how do you decide on what, or how do we all decide what we should optimize in our lives of the people we do influence with nudges? So, you know, now that we know that we can do it, you know, where do we actually infuse nudges in our lives?
Well, this is Rhonda. I know that there's this service that the theater uses when they have a new show. There are subscribers that get free tickets. So they're nudging by, you know, if they think that if they fill the audience at the beginning of the show, then the people who've paid, they'll think more highly of the play, and they'll get a better review and more people will come. And so they're nudging. So, you know, if you need the herd mentality, then if you want to move your life in a certain direction, then you know, then surround yourself with people. I mean, we hear this all the time, you know, surround yourself with people who have that common interest or who are doing that already or who have succeeded in that, you know, and you know, surround yourself with photographs of them, books they've written, you know, meet people that are doing it. You know, surround yourself with what you want to, you know, manifest in your life. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that old saying about, you know, a parent telling a child that they can't hang out with certain friends because it's, you know, unhealthy for them is actually true. You know, because those people that you hang out with are going to obviously, you know, engage you in choices that can be either positive or negative to your lifelong outcomes. Frank, you were going to say?
Yeah, I often hear that you are the average of the five people that you hang out with the most. And I don't know if that's 100% backed up by research, but it certainly sounds like good advice. And certainly is consistent with what our parents always told us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've always heard the rule that you take the your 10 closest you know, people in your life, and if you take their annual salaries, add them up and divide by 10, it's yours. And I don't know, again, if it's all too accurate, but, you know, it's certainly an interesting premise.
Yeah.
So what are some other examples of nudges in our lives, and how do you decide on which ones they are?
Well, of course, you know, for a long time when Internet Explorer was, you know, cornered the market, everybody was using Explorer because, well, it came bundled with Windows. So the path of least resistance was just simply use the browser that came anyway. You didn't have to download anything. And, you know, and as we remember, that was such a hot topic back then. And does Microsoft have the right to be able to bundle that that browser along with its software or along with its operating system? And, you know, the various things that you get from time to time, membership in a particular organization and the fee is such and such per year, and then they go ahead and by default add $2, which supports the whatever political initiative and blah, blah, blah. And it's optional. You can take it off, but they start out with, you know, this is the amount, including that. And so if you take the default and just pay what they said the amount was, well, you're contributing, and you have to make the decision to opt out of that $2 or whatever it is contribution. So I see that sort of stuff all the time.
Right, absolutely. You know, I see in my own organization, in my own company, you know, using the concept of nudge in all kinds of really fantastic ways. You know, again, using a default mechanism for being able to engage staff, you know, follow up with clients, you know, so that the default of our checklists are to generate a draft email template, you know, following up an interaction with a client so that they're capable of, you know, engaging with that client, showing gratitude, showing appreciation, asking if they need additional assistance. And since that's totally possible today with so much of the automation tools within our email programs, you know, giving those kinds of options, you know, you're not forcing them to send the email, but just popping up a new draft message and do it can't you with them, you know, they can delete it, or they can then say, oh, you know what, that would actually be a really good idea. So I see it opportunities to just leave a default opportunity for them to make the choice to use and then otherwise not.
Well, I would also use the example of climate change that, you know, I mean, the price of gas going up is not, I mean, it's not enough to deter people from driving cars and buying SUVs and all of that, because people don't feel the effects of the climate change. Like they're not living in some place like some mining town in Chile that's been completely, you know, messed up. The environment's been messed up and the drinking water contaminates and kills people. Or in Beijing or Taiwan where people wear masks because there's too much, you know, fumes in the air, and they have pollution days, and it's too dangerous for kids to go out on the street 50% of the time, and things
right,
like that.
Right.
So I think that, you know, if a nudge can't be, you know, we can't come up with a nudge, forcing people to travel and see these things up close and in person is really important. Like I had myself, you know, I grew up in a slum in Brooklyn, and so my neighbors were, you know, really poor, and so it really stuck with me, you know, that kind of experience, how people, you know, how people, what it's like, and I know that many people have never really seen a poor person up close, so if that's the case, they're not going to want to, you know, subsidize entitlements or any programs to pull people out of poverty. So I think it's really important that, you know, people, that somehow people aren't allowed to be isolated. And especially in big corporations, there needs to be programs where the employees get to see the effects of what the corporation is doing. And if they, you know, and the corporation has to be responsible for its actions, instead of hiding it from the employees. You know, there needs to be, you know, I don't know. I don't know how that works, but there needs to be some oversight, you know, on the top of even, corporate boards of directors where they, you know, at least where they're shown the effects of climate change and other things that are bad for the planet and the greater good.
Yeah, it's a very complex topic. One of the things that I go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, right. As Rhonda was, talking about seeing, specific examples, seeing a person that's embodied in poverty. If you think back to every presidential State of the Union address you've ever heard, the president can talk about statistics and that sort of thing in the overall picture. But then when they point to somebody in the audience, we have Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so from any town, USA, and they talk about the particular plight and how this piece of legislation, how it helped them. Even though it's only one case, it's suddenly it puts a face on it, it personalizes it, it hammers home the point much better than the statistics, which would actually be more representative of the effect. So, being able to put a face on it, being able to see it firsthand, be close to it, makes so much more of a difference.
Yeah, I was recently reading an article or something like that. I forget where I was reading it, but that, organizations that are doing, environmental cause-based work, they don't show pictures of spiders and ants. And that are endangered species. They show cuddly faces of panda bears and cute foxes and so on and so forth, because we all have a natural inclination to be aversive to serpents and to spiders and things of that nature versus, being and having an affinity for those things that are cute and cuddly. So, we're naturally going to be more inclined to give money or to show a greater affinity toward cute little, panda cubs and such and that type of thing. So yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It certainly makes a lot of sense. I'm curious from the folks on the call, when do you think a nudge is basically not a nudge anymore? Basically when it becomes what they call a shove, it becomes coercive. There's a point in when we need to choose to nudge and when not to nudge. And why shouldn't we shove people? Why shouldn't we make them, do things? Why shouldn't we be coercive when people already make bad decisions? So if we know that the social science tells us that there are these fallacies and biases, from anchoring to availability bias to representative heuristics, all of these types of things, herd mentality and status quo bias, as the authors talk about, why shouldn't we shove people? And when does a nudge become a little bit too much? When does it become an actual shove? Anybody have thoughts on that? And how you can sort of check that in your own, sort of productivity system and productivity world?
Yeah, I guess when that nudge is pushing people where people have a choice, but it's a choice between two bad alternatives. Thinking of a situation here in the state of Alabama with retired educators and so forth, and of course we pay a monthly premium for our insurance as retired people. And as a bonus for our premium not going up $50 a month, how they word this, in reward for in order for your premium not to go up to $50 a month, all these hoops that you have to jump through in terms of going to the internet and reading all of these articles on being healthy and participating in online coaching to be more healthy. I even had a friend who was told that he needed to start an exercise program by his online coach. Little did the online coach know, my friend runs marathons on a weekly basis. So here's the alternative between your premium is go up $50 a month or you jump through all of these hoops. And, of course, the nudge is to try to get you to jump through the hoops.
Yeah, I start to think about, situations like, I'm going to use a very dramatic example, but shrinking the sizes of the hallways in buildings so that when people walk through them, if they're too big to fit through, then they have to lose weight, that kind of thing. That becomes, that's how I see a nudge no longer becoming a nudge but sort of becoming a shove, or making seats on buses smaller so that basically someone who you know, would be of larger size would basically have a problem. It's a way in which people who may or may not, you know, that fits. What happens is, you know, I see a nudge becoming a shove when things that may not, you have people who may not be the people you want to affect become affected. For example, if you have someone who just is a big football player sized guy or woman, you know, sitting in a chair as who's now, you know, basically made to feel uncomfortable and unwelcomed because, you know, they happen to be a larger frame naturally, not because they're overweight at all, they become affected. So I start to see those things as being the things that make a nudge no longer a shove. And, you know, for me, I think that, you know, we should be choosing when to nudge when we know that there's obviously a direct benefit, and the benefit raises above a particular threshold. And that's going to be very case by case, you know, but we shouldn't just be nudging people into useless better choices, choices that don't have a dramatic benefit, either. Again, we're talking about long term, you know, so if you're going to raise someone's retirement, by just a couple dollars over the course of 30 years, I don't think that's really necessary. But if you're going to double that retirement, you know, because of compound interest or dividends over that time frame, that makes a lot of sense. So, you know, I think it needs to have actually a pretty some threshold of higher benefit for that nudge to even be chosen, and, you know, that kind of thing. And then to answer my own question about why not just shove people, I think people generally work better with positive reinforcement. I've always been a dissenting vote on the Supreme Court of Productivity when it says that we should be using any kind of negative reward or reinforcement. These ideas of telling people that you should. I recently was on a productivity panel discussion in New York City, and one of the panelists talked about a device that goes on your wrist. And so you wear this device, and you tell it when certain things are happening. So it can actually, like, shock you or vibrate or other types of things when you do or don't do things that you're supposed to do. So, you know, like it says, you know, I ate a cookie. Well, when you eat a cookie, it'll, you know, tell the system. I'm not sure how that works, but basically you tell the app,